You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of March, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the votes may have been cast, but the counting still carries on. We'll have the latest on the Kenyan elections with our man in Nairobi, Tristan McConnell. We'll also be asking, with just 6 months to go until a general election, what's gone wrong for Germany's SPD? And she was one of the most iconic fashion magazine editors of all time. A new biography of Diana Vreeland is out. We'll meet the author.
She had an extraordinary imagination, even as a child. So she was able to escape very easily from this unhappy surroundings into a parallel fantasy world.
Plus, it's Friday, so we'll be assessing the week in news with our editor, Andrew Tuck, and we'll be getting out of the office to meet the neighbours. Today, we head to Tokyo.
Bonsai is uniquely Japanese. It involves creativity to picture a landscape you might have seen before somewhere and realize it in a vase by using plants.
All that, plus, of course, we play some music too. So really, what better way to prepare for the weekend than joining me for the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, let's cross over to the other side of the desk where Paul Osborne has the latest news headlines from around the world.
Officials counting the votes in Kenya's presidential election say they'll issue a final result within hours. The race remains incredibly tight between the front-runner Uhuru Kenyatta and the current Prime Minister Raila Odinga. But the votes still to be counted are from areas where Mr. Kenyatta has strong support. In Nairobi, there's growing pressure to publish the result.
It's causing a lot of anxiety amongst people. We as the electorate, we did our part and turned out in large numbers and voted. So I think it's only fair that they do their part, they give us the results in good time.
Just give them time so that they give us exactly what they have got.
The state funeral of Hugo Chavez is taking place in Venezuela's capital, Caracas. Leaders from more than 30 countries are attending, including the president of Iran. A delegation has also been sent from the United States. Mr. Chavez died on Tuesday after 2 years' treatment for cancer. The UN says it's doing all it can to secure the freedom of 21 peacekeepers who are being held by kidnappers in Syria. They were seized near the Golan Heights in the south of the country. The village where they're being held is under heavy bombardment by Syrian government forces. Ev Latsou from the UN's peacekeeping mission says they may be able to negotiate a temporary truce.
There is the possibility that a ceasefire of a few hours can intervene, which would allow for our people to be released.
A man described as Osama bin Laden's spokesman has appeared in a court in New York and denied helping to plot the September 11th attacks. Suleiman Abu Ghaith was handed over to the US after being captured in Jordan. A son-in-law of bin Laden, prosecutors say he occupied a central role in Al-Qaeda. China is appealing for calm on the Korean Peninsula after North Korea cancelled all peacekeeping pacts with the South. It's in response to yesterday's vote at the UN to impose further sanctions on Pyongyang after its latest nuclear test. Beijing backed the latest sanctions, but has also called for dialogue to stop the situation getting any worse. The conclave to elect a new pope will begin next Tuesday. The announcement follows a meeting in Rome of the 115 cardinals who will choose Pope Benedict's successor. They'll continue to vote until one candidate wins the support of two-thirds of them. Vatican Press Secretary Father Thomas Rosica thinks there could be a final decision by the end of next week.
It's been a great week for all of us, a week of great expectation. The important thing is the conclave is early next week, and I have every confidence that by the end of next week, we might see some white smoke.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. It's 18.04 here in London, 13.04 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
There is still no election result in Kenya. It's been 4 days since the polls closed, four long, anxious, nail-biting days filled with rumour, fear-mongering, allegations of tampering, both serious and spurious, and most importantly, in a country that knows just what can happen when an election result is flawed, enormous reserves of patience, patience that frankly you or I would struggle to find. It's getting dark in Nairobi, the weekend is about to begin, and no one really knows what comes next. Trista McConnell, our Nairobi correspondent, has been reporting for us all week and joins me again now. Tristan, it looks like we may get a result in the next few hours, although we've been here before over the past few days. How likely is it that everyone will be put out of their misery?
Yeah, I think May is the word. Look, they've got about 40 more constituencies to count. That's out of a total of 290, but it's been moving pretty slowly today. In fact, since about 9 o'clock this morning, so about 12 hours ago, they've got through 40 constituencies. So the Electoral Commission keeps insisting that they will come out with a final result by the end of the day, which would be midnight my time, which is about 3 hours' time. But it's still quite a tall order. But that's the target they set themselves, and they reiterated it just a couple of hours ago at the last press briefing. So it's possible that we'll get a result, if not by midnight, maybe in the early hours of tomorrow morning.
So now, just clarify something for me here. Is this actual counting of votes, or is it simply collating the results from the different polling stations?
What it is we've got returning officers coming in from all 290 constituencies clutching pieces of paper. And on those pieces of paper are written the results from every polling station and every polling centre in the constituency. So they're not actually adding up individual ballot papers anymore. That was done overnight Monday and into Tuesday morning. So the returning officers are travelling, some of them from quite far away. And then the numbers are being inputted into the system and added up here in Nairobi and kind of cross-checked and collated and archived and whatnot. And once they've sort of made sure that everything adds up properly, they then get released to the public. And I think the final returning officers made it to Nairobi earlier today. So all the results are in. It's just a question of counting and cross-checking and then releasing.
And now there are many thousands of observers. There's several thousand official Kenyan election observers. There's also a African Union and Commonwealth mission and an EU mission too. I assume you've been speaking to those observers, you know, going back 5 years ago to the last election when I was in Nairobi. I remember the observers by this stage getting incredibly anxious, telling stories about how these numbers didn't quite seem right, how they're being locked out of rooms they were supposed to be allowed to observe. Have we had any repeat of that yet, or are the observers still relatively comfortable with the process?
Yeah, the observers this time have been pretty happy. They were very happy with Election Day itself, and that's understandable. I mean, the voters turned out in high numbers and showed a great degree of patience waiting in queues in the hot sun for hours on end, in some cases, to cast their vote. They've been a bit disappointed, as has everyone, frankly, with the failure of a whole host of kind of technological measures that were put in place to try and secure the vote against fraud. And that's something that I think everyone will be looking at very closely once we get past this process of actually getting a result out. But there hasn't been any repeat of this kind of deliberate obscuring of the processes or anything like that. So most of the stuff I'm getting from the observers is, yes, there have been a whole series of human errors, examples of incompetence and technological breakdowns, but they don't see anything malign or conspiratorial behind it.
Now, talk us through what happens next, because we're in a situation where if no candidate wins 50% plus one, then there's a second round. Uhuru Kenyatta, who is the candidate who is going to at some stage face trial at the International Criminal Court, is around the 50% mark. So one chance is that he wins. The other chance is he doesn't, and it's a runoff between him and Raila Odinga. But if either of those results happens, will it lead to an Uhuru presidency or a second round, or will either side go to the courts?
I think the answers are both, and in fact, all of the above. I think what Huracán Nyato has been in the lead right from the start. Today, as we're getting closer and closer to a final tally, he's been sort of rising above and then dipping below this crucial 50% mark. I mean, really, the numbers of votes which we hear tallied here and there are kind of irrelevant. All that matters, the only thing that matters, is will Huracán Nyato make it beyond the 50% mark? And the latest count, which was about half an hour ago, the most recent results, got him at 49.9%. He's been up at 1.51%, you know.
So he's
up and down around the 50 mark. But he does look like he's in a strong position, which means we probably are looking at an Huracán Nyato presidency and a whole host of legal challenges from his from Raila Odinga.
Tristan McConnell in Nairobi, thank you very much indeed. And of course, if that result does come out in the next few hours, then we may well be back in Nairobi on the Monocle Daily tonight to find out some reaction from Tristan. You are currently listening to Midori House. Stay tuned, because after this short break, we'll be asking the Financial Times' Quentin Peel what's gone wrong for Germany's Peer Steinbrück and his SPD party.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
You're listening to Midori House, 1913 in Berlin, 1813 here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. In a moment, we'll be taking a look back at the week's news with our editor, Andrew Tuck. But first, we are crossing to Berlin. A decade ago, Germany's then Chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, introduced a series of reforms aimed at liberalising the country's then struggling economy. Though criticised by many on the left, few today would argue that Agenda 2010, as it was known, has not been a success. Peer Steinbrück was one of the plan's key architects. When Steinbrück was last year chosen as the man to take on Angela Merkel in September's general election, it was thought that his reputation for fiscal prudence may well be an advantage. It hasn't quite worked out like that. Steinbrück has instead earned himself a new reputation as someone with the unfortunate habit of putting his foot in his mouth very often. From moaning about the Chancellor's supposedly low salary to criticising Italian politicians, he's had a rough few months. Joining me on the line now to explain further is Quentin Peel, a Berlin bureau chief for the Financial Times, who's been writing about this issue today. Quentin, welcome back to Midori House. Just what has gone wrong with poor Peer?
I think part of the problem is that he has a very quick wit and a very sharp tongue. And he tends to talk before he thinks about things. The truth is that when he says that the Italian elections have been won by two clowns,
he's right.
I think probably most of the population of Germany would agree with him. But it wasn't very diplomatic to say it just when the Italian president was in Berlin, and he cancelled the dinner he was having with him. And so poor old Peer Steinbrück comes out of the thing looking like an undiplomatic, not the sort of person you really want to be German Chancellor. So I think that really his mouth has run away with him.
And he's got another problem as well, which is more of a policy problem, a political problem, in that he is on the right of the SPD, and the SPD's many people within the party are perhaps more to the left of him. And it's all very well being on the right of a centre-left party if you are a vote winner, a la Tony Blair, but it's less helpful if you're at 25% in the polls.
Yes, absolutely. And I think really this is the problem. I think it was always going to be a problem for Steinbrück from the moment that he was nominated. He was the most personable candidate they had, the one who could probably take the fight best to Angela Merkel. I mean, there's a real problem for the SPD in that Merkel is hugely popular in Germany. But also the problem is that the party is split. And it split over precisely those reforms you were talking about 10 years ago, Agenda 2010. This was liberalizing the labor market, making it easier to hire and fire people, introducing a lot more temporary work. And this really didn't go down well with the left wing of the Social Democratic Party. And the party's been struggling really to hold itself together ever since. And in comes Peer Steinbrück, clearly representing the reformists, school, pro-Agenda 2010, and there are a lot of people who want him to run on a much more left-wing campaign, and it's just not working. He's a right-winger, and he's got a more left-wing campaign. It doesn't ring true.
What's curious about this as well is that he doesn't seem to have benefited at all from the supposed success of Agenda 2010. No one's saying, oh, well done, Peer Steinbrück, we really like those reforms, we'll back you now, are they?
And the truth is that it's Angela Merkel who's taken the credit for the performance of the German economy. Now, there are people out there who say, actually, Agenda 2010 isn't what's gone right. That the fact that unemployment's come down by, a million and a half or more, is actually much more to do with the slow growth of the German population and the workforce than it is to do with a more efficient labour market. So there's a big argument about what works and what doesn't work. But at the end of the day, the SPD, because it doesn't want to take the credit for these reforms, hasn't got any credit for them. And Angela Merkel is way out in front in the polls, so she's the person they've got to beat. And they're trailing a long way behind.
And now, that poll lead is very large, but it's not necessarily all over for Peer Steinbrück, because if you look at recent polls, if you add up the SPD's vote with the Green vote, then you could get a red-green coalition that is almost at parity with Angela Merkel, particularly if her current allies, the Free Liberals, don't reach that crucial 5% mark, which means you actually get into the Bundestag. Do you think am I clutching at straws there for those people on the left, or is there something in there? Is there still a chance for them to pull it around?
Well, you're not clutching at straws, because the mathematics of it are really very difficult, among others, for Angela Merkel, because she's got, let's say, 40%, 41%. On her own, she has no majority. She needs a partner. And her partners, the Free Democrats, they're looking very weak at the moment. They'll probably just about scrape back into Parliament with, let's say, 5 or 6%. That would give her 46, 47%. Still just short of a majority. On the other side, the Social Democrats and the Greens, what they call the Red-Green Coalition, is exactly the same, also short of a majority. So the chances are you're going to have a deal across the lines. Either Mrs. Merkel will have to turn to the Social Democrats and have a grand coalition of left and right, or she'll have to turn to the Greens, which they've never done before, and have what they call a black-green coalition, which would be a real turn-up for the books. Now, everybody thinks it's probably going to be a grand coalition of the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats, just as it was the first time that Merkel became Chancellor.
And, of course,
who
was working in her government then? Peer Steinbrück.
Peer Steinbrück. He's adamant he won't do it again. The man who looks like winning out of this whole process is actually his good friend Frank-Walter Steinmeier, who's the leader of the Social Democrats in the German Bundestag, because he's sitting quietly, not really fighting very much in this election. But if it is a grand coalition, he's probably going to end up as vice chancellor and foreign minister, which is exactly the job he's always wanted.
And he may not be a good friend of Per Steinbrück for much longer if that happens. Quentin Peel, as ever, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monaco 24. This is Monaco 24. London, New York, Tokyo. Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monaco 24.
And you're with Midori House, 1820 here in London, 1320 in Washington, D.C., New York City, indeed all over the East Coast of America. If you're joining us from there, welcome. It is that time of the week on Midori House when we look back at the week in news and the stories that have caught the attention of our editors here at Monocle. Normally, there's a few of us around the table, but everyone is away. Aside from Andrew Tuck.
Yeah, I'm here. Tyler Brulé is off in Japan as we speak.
Yeah.
Tom Edwards did The Globalist, claimed he had to go home and sleep.
Yeah. Sophie Grove did The Globalist as well.
I'm not going to say anything. And they both left at the same time, but hey. So you've got me.
So it's me and you.
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's more than enough, Andrew. More than enough. So there's obviously been two big stories this week. Obviously, and both involve colourful leaders. We can talk about North Korea in a bit, but first of all, let's talk about Hugo Chavez and his death.
Well, this is certainly the story that dominated the headlines this week, and rightfully so. But oddly, the one which may have kind of less legs to it, in a sense. I think the North Korean story is going to be something that we're going to be more engaged with over the coming weeks. The death of Hugo Chavez didn't exactly come as a surprise, but it puts a focus on whether one man or one woman really does kind of control everything that happens within a region. I think he's been the bogeyman for both Europe and for the North America. He's been seen as the person who's kind of stopped the Americans having influence within Latin America and encouraged the taking of lots of companies that belong to the likes of Spain, like Repsol. But it will be interesting to see whether anything really changes. The Americans are betting, actually, that Maduro is more of a pragmatist and that they will be able to get things out of him that they couldn't always get out of Hugo Chavez.
It was interesting, though. We had Sarah Granger, our former Caracas correspondent, in studio earlier this week, just after Chavez's death. And she was saying, you know, actually, in a sense, Chavez was far more flexible and pragmatic than many people gave him credit, because he still did business with the US. He still did business with the bond market. He sold an awful lot of oil to America. Do you think that, you know, perhaps there is an opportunity for Barack Obama here, who's, you know, despite saying warm words about life south of the Rio Grande, has never really focused on Latin America that much, that this is an opportunity for him to perhaps think about those relationships there?
I think it's possible for Obama to think about it, but I think what's more complex is that for any government in Venezuela, oddly, even if I think Capriles did win the next election, I think it's very difficult for them to reset the rhetoric, because the aura of Chavez is going to stay in Venezuela for so long. And, you know, he was very funny about, you know, America. He was very good at kind of tweaking the tail of his northern neighbours. And I don't think that it's possible at this point for them to row back and say, well, actually, just forget all that. We'll have a fresh start. I think that it's too entrenched. And for many of the voters who Maduro needs to kind of woo in the coming elections, he just has to be very careful what he says about the US. He doesn't actually have a huge amount of room to maneuver.
It's interesting that, you know, Chavez had this dream of being you know, this icon for the left in Latin America and beyond, but certainly in Latin America. And at the start, it seemed like he was very influential. But almost as soon as Lula da Silva won in 2002 in Brazil, you suddenly saw a different model of centre-left government in Latin America that was willing to be, you know, yes, stand up for the poor and make life a lot better for the working classes, but could also be friends with America. And his rhetoric was very different.
Well, I think there's two interesting things here. I think that Chavez was seen as inheriting slightly that mantle of the revolutionary, the Che Guevara, the Castro, and that's why he did ally himself with Castro, and that's why Raul Castro is currently in Caracas attending the funeral, and that's why most of those kind of leaders. Evo Morales is there. The Ahmadinejads have turned up. That's why they're there at the funeral, because he has inherited that mantle. But you're right on the economic side. Hey, God, you'd rather be Brazilian than Venezuelan. Even on the elements of social, the way society works. That Venezuelan society has undoubtedly begun to unravel. The murder rate is extraordinary, whereas those things have kind of eased away a little bit in Brazil. And I think that Brazil was quite clever. It kind of didn't try to kind of push him away, to kind of let him do his thing. But actually, they just kind of set up a model that was much more admirable.
Before we move on to North Korea, quick quiz question for you.
This is about to fail.
No. Everyone will fail this. I failed this. Everyone's failed it. Who was Venezuela's president before Hugo Chavez?
That I don't know.
No one knows. I mean, I know because I just I've written down indeed some Venezuelans do. Although a number of Venezuelan experts I've spoken to this week, when I've asked them that question, have been like, and there's been some frantic googling going on. Anyway, I will give the answer to that later in the show. Don't cheat at home. Don't Google it. See if you can guess. North Korea. Let's talk about another rather colourful leader. This one very much still with us.
It's interesting. He is a leader, but he's a mafia boss, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing, the death of the Godfather, and a young pretender taking over the territory, and he literally is a mafia king. They make their money through illegal sales of products and smuggling money and doing dodgy deals, and suddenly he's getting corralled and. Even China now is bored of him. And that's the most fascinating thing about the new round of sanctions. They're co-authored by China. This is the country that fought with North Korea against the South and against the Americans. And now suddenly they're helping write this piece of, very restrictive sanctions that undoubtedly are going to kind of tweak their tail. And lots of it is actually, when you read through it, I'm not sure how much of it is really going to hurt. Some of it is about stopping the import of luxury goods. So you can't sell yachts to North Korea anymore.
Because there was a booming yacht selling business
exactly.
There, wasn't there?
And you can't send luxury watches. But I guess he's probably got enough of those already. And if you really wanted one, I think that's probably still quite easy to smuggle in.
So is your fear that he is essentially a chubby Michael Corleone?
I think he is, and I think the interesting thing is that he's trying to prove himself. So he's absolutely unpredictable. So nobody can work with him. Even the Chinese, I think, must think, oh my God, what's this guy up to? They're trying to second guess what he wants, and nobody actually knows what he wants, because actually, even the new South Korean president has said that she would enter a kind of realpolitik to try and open up lines of discussion and give him what he wants, and he's not happy about it.
Andrew Tuck, thank you very much indeed. Now, Andrew, I'm sure you're aware what day it is today. It's International Women's Day. And we are celebrating this here on Midori House with a song chosen by our producer, Case Bilbao. This is Bjork with Earth Intruders.
Sharpshooters, the cold parachuters necessary.
Bjork there with Earth Intruders, and the answer to the quiz. You know what? I'm going to say that for later. For who the last Venezuelan president is. Honestly, please don't Google it. That's just cheating. But have a good thing. There we are. In the next half hour of the programme, we're going to be hearing about Bombardier's new aircraft. We'll meet some of our neighbours in Tokyo and explore a new biography of Diane Vreeland.
She had an extraordinary imagination, even as a child. So she was able to escape very easily from this unhappy surroundings into a parallel fantasy world.
But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
The body overseeing Kenya's presidential election has announced it's to carry out an audit of the votes already counted. Almost 90% of constituencies have now declared their results. Though the race remains tight, the frontrunner Uhuru Kenyatta is closing in on the 50% of votes he needs for an outright victory. The state funeral of Hugo Chavez is taking place in the Venezuelan capital Caracas. Leaders from more than 30 countries are attending, among them the president of Iran. Mr. Chavez died on Tuesday. The UN has said it's working around the clock to secure the freedom of 21 peacekeepers who are being held by kidnappers in Syria. They were seized earlier this week near the Golan Heights in the south of the country. The village where they're being held is under heavy bombardment, though the UN says it may be able to negotiate a temporary truce to get them out. A man who'd been described as the chief spokesman for Osama bin Laden has appeared before a court in New York, where he's been accused of helping to plot the September 11th attacks. Suleiman Abu Ghaith was handed over to the US after he was captured in Jordan. He's a son-in-law of bin Laden. And the conclave to elect a new pope will begin next Tuesday. The announcement follows a meeting in Rome of the 115 cardinals, who between them will choose Pope Benedict's successor. They'll begin voting on Tuesday and continue until one candidate wins the support of two-thirds of them. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. I'm going to give you the answer to the quiz question now, because otherwise I'll forget, and frankly, you know, no one's going to get it. I honestly did have to Google this. The last president of Venezuela before Hugo Chavez, Rafael Caldera. There we are. That just goes to show how impressive, in a sense, he's been in putting Venezuela on the map, for good or bad. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Yesterday, Canadian transport giant Bombardier unveiled the first fully assembled 145-seat C-Series jet. It's set to begin flight testing this year. In addition to the rollout, company brass confirmed they would indeed make a bigger version of the plane with as many as 160 seats. This catapults the company into the existing dogfight between Boeing and Airbus, currently in stiff competition for the single-aisle jet market. For more on this, our transport editor Tristan McAllister joins us from Monocle's New York Bureau. Tristan, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Why do you believe Bombardier are treading into this territory when, let's face it, Airbus and Boeing have been battling this out for rather a long time?
Good evening, Steve. I think the answer here is pretty simple. If you look at the numbers actually just recently released by Boeing in terms of a market outlook, we see the single aisle market up to the year 2031, 27,430. That's the number of planes that Boeing expects to belong in the marketplace by 2031. So if you look at those numbers, it would seem there's a lot of room for both Boeing, Airbus, and for Bombardier to have a piece of that market.
And why do Bombardier think that they can actually do it? What makes them think that they might be better than Boeing and Airbus?
I think the big thing here, Steve, is that both Boeing and Airbus had lots of discussions, and there was a lot of speculation internally and then also in the press and in the media and sort of the commercial aviation world as to whether or not Boeing should re-engineer the 737 or come up with a whole new single-aisle jet. And the same went for Airbus. What ended up happening in the end was Airbus opted for what they're calling the A320neo, and Boeing opted for what they call the 737 MAX. They are very similar, at least in terms of profile, as the existing 737 or A320 models, but they have added fuel efficiency, added range, they have different interiors. But beyond that, what you see was that there wasn't a whole lot of push toward a next-generation type airplane. And what the Bombardier C-Series is a next-generation type airplane. It uses composites where they hadn't been used before, at least not in the single-aisle market. It has a new engine. It essentially fills a space that both Boeing and Airbus were not willing to bet on in terms of a new aircraft. So for lack of a better term, it's really a game changer. This is a quieter airplane. It has range that is really unheard of in terms of that size of an airplane. And then with this announcement that they would take it to a 160-seat aircraft, possibly what they call a derivative, in 2014, it means that it's going to be direct in competition with the A320 and the 737. And again, that's a dogfight that both Airbus and Boeing have been in for a while. A very, very profitable place in the market for both those airframers.
Boeing managed to churn out, unbelievably, one 737 every single day. You and I have both been at the to Everett and seen them do this, and it's quite astonishing they managed to do that, which I think just underlines how difficult this might be for Bombardier. Let's talk about orders. I mean, do they have enough to sort of to get going, to really sort of give them a boost?
What we're seeing is numbers-wise, their orders aren't necessarily where they wanted them to be, and the company has admitted to that. They projected that they would be much higher. Right now, we're seeing 13 customers with 180 firm orders. Now, commitments is different than orders, and intent to buy different than orders, so there's a lot of interest in the airplane, and it's much lower than what you saw with a brand new airplane like the 787, which was around 800 by the time the airplane actually went to market, and then the A380, which was right around 200 when it actually went to market. So I think it's sort of a wait and see game at this point.
Well, we will do just that. Tristan McAllister, our transport editor, live from our New York bureau. Thank you very much for joining me here on Midori House. We'll be right back after this to hear what was really going through the mind of Diane Vreeland from her biographer.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes bodacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs, the living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 1939 in Paris, 1839 here in London, 1339 in New York City. In a moment, we'll hear from Diane Vreeland's new biographer and take us there. I mean, really, what else could we play but this? The mighty Madonna there with Vogue, which lines us up nicely for our next story. Diana Vreeland was the epitome of a fashion editor. Initially at Harper's Bazaar, Vreeland then moved to Vogue, where her name topped the masthead for a decade. It was her style and creativity which laid the groundwork for subsequent editors such as Anna Wintour. A documentary about Vreeland's life was released last year, and author Amanda Mackenzie Stewart has just finished a new biography. She stopped by Midori House a little earlier today to tell Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about Vreeland's fascinating and colourful life.
This book is, in fact, my second book, and my first book was about somebody called Consuelo Vanderbilt, who married the Duke of Marlborough in 1895. And Diana Vreeland was very fascinated by Consuelo Vanderbilt. She saw her as a great woman of style, sent people to interview her in the 1960s, and later put Consuelo into one of her exhibitions in the 1970s. And when I was researching that book, I came across this figure, Diana Vreeland, who I really barely knew. I mean, I was aware of her, like many people are kind of aware of her, but I didn't really know anything about her. So really partly as to do the proper research for the Consuelo Vanderbilt book, I started to investigate Diana Vreeland a bit more. And when it then became a case of finding a subject for my next book that might work on both sides of the Atlantic, she really was there, kind of ready-made in front of me.
So maybe let's start then with her childhood.
Yes.
When did she get into fashion?
She really, I don't think, had a very happy childhood. And the reason for the unhappiness in her family was to do with looks, appearance, beauty. She had the misfortune to be the rather plain child in a family of beauties. She had a beautiful society mother. She had a very handsome British father. And she had a very nice younger sister, but who was really startlingly pretty and easy and academic and sporty and the sister for whom everything flowed easily. And Diana Vreeland as a child really had a very strong sense of herself as the ugly duckling of the family, and that her mother was ashamed of her because of her looks. And it made for a very, very unhappy dynamic in the family.
And how funny that she ended up editing Vogue and Bazaar as well, which is the maximum of beauty that you could ever had.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? When I was writing the book, I did come to think it was a bit too easy just to say, well, you know, it's kind of obvious. She was the ugly duckling of the family. She suffered greatly as a result. And then she became somehow obsessed with appearances because of this kind of gotta complex, and was obsessed with appearances. And that's what drove her. I thought it was actually more interesting to ask the question, what was it that made her so resilient in the face of this rather difficult childhood? And I think the answer was that she had an extraordinary imagination, even as a child. So she was able to escape very easily from this unhappy surroundings into a parallel fantasy world. And we can see her doing this from a teenage diary which she kept when she was 14. And this parallel fantasy world had a great deal to do with this creature she called the girl, which was a sort of edited best version of herself. And there is much in this diary about how she's going to transform herself and transform her appearance and transform the way she looks. And you can see her working all of this out in 1918, when she was 14, going on 15. And the point about it really was that it worked. She went through an enormous effort of self-production and self-improvement and self-editing at that age. And it got her, she discovered really that if you change the way you look, the way the world looks at you can change too. And she suddenly found she was making friends. And it was, in a way, a quite self-conscious process that started young, but it came out of a great imagination.
And let's talk a little bit about her work. I believe her major breakthrough was when she started editing Bazaar, right?
Or not quite, no. She started, I suppose, in contemporary terms, quite late in terms of her career. The Vreelands had a 5.5-year period in Europe where they met many, many stylish people. They went back to New York on account of Diana's husband's job, and she kind of knew she was going to have to earn some money. And then she was talent spotted by the editor of Bazaar, who was an extraordinary woman called Carmel Snow. And I think it's fairly clear that Carmel Snow knew that she had this extraordinary person in front of her, but she didn't quite know what to do with her. And finally, they came up with a solution, which was this column that Diana started to produce called the Why Don't You column. And this was a list of really quite extraordinarily ornate suggestions for living a stylish life were, I mean, well, they didn't just apply to fashion, these suggestions, all sorts of suggestions for all kinds of aspects of stylish living, like, why don't you bring back from Central Europe a huge white Baroque porcelain stove to stand in your front hall, reflected in the parquet? And there are many, many famous suggestions for how to make your children look suitably decorative. One of the most famous or infamous is, why don't you rinse your blonde child's hair in dead champagne to keep its gold as they do in France?
Great tip.
great tip. But no, there was tips for making smoking a cigarette more stylish. Why don't you have your cigarette stamped with a personal insignia, as a well-known explorer did with his penguin? One of my favourites.
And how Diana moved from Bazaar to Vogue? How was this
Well,
process?
She was at Bazaar as fashion editor, not as editor-in-chief, but as fashion editor for a very long time. She officially became fashion editor of Harper's Bazaar in 1939, and she stayed at Bazaar for many years until 1962. But there were problems in the final years of Bazaar. Carmel Snow retired. She was replaced by somebody that Diana Vreeland found less sympathetic. And there was also the issue of money. It's just extraordinary now the extent to which these very talented women, including the editor, Carmel Snow, were always paid far less than the men in the Hearst organisation. So Diana asked for a pay rise and they offered her $1,000. And that really was the last straw. So she jumped ship to Vogue.
And can you compare Diana with other fashion editors, especially more contemporary ones, like Anna Wintour? I have a feeling Anna Wintour is kind of more business-like and Diana is more about dreams and...
Well, I think that's probably right. And I'm not sure that Diana Vreeland would necessarily be given Anna Wintour's job now. I mean, this is not to take anything away from Anna Wintour. The industry has just changed out of all recognition. It's become this enormous global industry. So to sit in that position, to have that authority, is a very different job. Diana Vreeland also really fundamentally, I think, had this very, very close relationship with the reader of Vogue. It was really the reader with whom she was fundamentally very aligned. I mean, she, in spite of all these things that she did, she would always call herself an amateur who had just wandered into fashion by mistake. So she was really very interested throughout her life in this creature that really we first see appearing in her diary, who's the girl, you know? What this gap between how you are and how you'd like to be. And she thought that by interesting and inspiring women with all these shoots and all these possibilities and all, making you the editor of your own life and the somebody who was in charge of creative possibilities, that was the way to inspire women and loosen their purse strings.
That was Amanda Mackenzie Stewart talking to our Fernanda Augusta Pacheco. And Amanda's book, Diana Vreeland, Empress of Fashion, is out now. You're listening to Midori House, where it's that time of the week where we go out and meet our neighbours. And today we're heading to our bureau in Tokyo. In our recent visits there, we've met a Japanese coffee house and a paper boutique. This time around, Monocle's Jun Toyofoku has paid a visit to a hidden bonsai school in Omotesando.
西川盆栽教室の早川由美と申します。My name is Yumi Hayakawa at Saika Bonsai School. We have our headquarters in Bonsai Town in Saitama Prefecture, and this school is our Omotesando campus for our students to enjoy learning about bonsai. Our headquarters, called Seikoen in Bonsai Town, was founded in mid-1800s, and this Omotesando school opened in 2009. This Omotesando school is sitting in a flat in Jingumae area. We have around 250 students, and they attend a monthly seminar to create and treat bonsai. We have everybody from a primary school boy to the elderly, of course. 80% of our students are female, and 20% are male. Bonsai is uniquely Japanese. It involves creativity to picture a landscape you might have seen before somewhere and realize it in a vase by using plants. At this bonsai school, we create a palm-sized bonsai using a few different trees and flowers. It depends on what class you're enrolled in, but mostly everybody creates the same bonsai at one session and look after it at home. Next month, they bring their bonsai back to school for a treatment. For example, you trim the tree you planted to shape it as it grows. Also, there is a bonsai technique called harigane kake, and this is to direct the branches and limbs by hooking the wire on them. You can also replant your bonsai to a bigger vase once its root has grown in the vase. Bonsai's fun is to keep the tree in a relatively small vase and yet to present it in a way that looks more aged than it actually is. To replicate a tall old tree in your neighborhood on the palm of your hand at your home and to create such a landscape, that is the joy of bonsai. Of course, many of our students enjoy bonsai as a sort of extension of gardening and looking after flowers. The lifespan of a plant really depends on the tree. For example, at Bonsai Town, we have over 500 years old bonsai. It's quite big, around 50 centimeters to a meter tall, but still aging in a relatively small vase. Of course, there is a list of things you need to do. However, the most important thing is to love and care for your bonsai. With that emotion, you don't feel that you're forced to look after it. Look after your bonsai just like the way you'd keep a pet. That would be the key to enjoy bonsai for a long period of time.
That was Yumi Hayawaka at the Saika Bonsai School, just around the corner from our Tokyo bureau. We're nearly at the end of the programme here on Midori House. We just have time to squeeze in our daily comment piece. All the way from Toronto, here's our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, reflecting on an ingenious way of moving house.
One of the more bizarre stories to emerge in the architecture news of late is about one couple's attempt to keep their Frank Lloyd Wright-designed house in New Jersey alive. The Backman Wilson house was designed in 1954 and is today owned by an architect couple called Mr. and Mrs. Tarantino. For its sins, it was built on the riverfront at Millstone, New Jersey, and after repeated flooding, the Tarantinos want to move. They don't just want to move themselves, though. They want to move the house too, brick by brick, to a new location to save it. Their asking price is $1.5 million, which includes the sale and the deconstruction of the house. The project has garnered a strange amount of press, in no small part because one of the potential buyers is an Italian architect, Paolo Bulletti. He has more ambitious plans than simply shifting the house upstate. He wants to ship the house across the Atlantic, into the Mediterranean, and leave it perched at Fiesole, above Florence, like a mid-century Noah's Ark escaping the flood, but with less animals, one hopes. Following a scandalous affair in 1910, Lloyd Wright himself escaped to Fiesole to hide with his mistress, so it would make a fitting resting place for the Backman Wilson house. Due to Italian permits, though, the house would become a museum piece or garden sculpture. It could not be lived in. Comment threads suggest a healthy degree of outrage at the whole matter. Do they ever not? The Tarantinos, though, have worked closely with the Lloyd Wright Foundation. It's hardly as if they're flogging it brick for brick in the back streets of Italy. They are giving a new chapter of life to a building they have lived in and loved for 25 years, whether it can remain a home or not. The very story of its survival, a rock against the flood, singles it out for attention. Meanwhile, over on the rugged, sea-battered west coast of Newfoundland in Canada, I'm witnessing a very different approach. Rickety wooden houses and sheds perch precariously on the remote islands. Simple, effective structures whose uniform, boxy exteriors belie the comfort and often stifling warmth inside. Every so often, winding around the little coastal road, it's clear the elements have won. You spot a squashed wooden structure on the verge of giving one last woody wheeze and creak before plummeting into the sea. "There he goes. He's had a good life," says my guide, referring to the house as an old man. These are not Lloyd Wright houses, but they are still homes. It's a thought-provoking, dignified attitude towards possession and knowing when to let go. It leaves me wondering if the online outrage might be any less angry if the Tarantinos just let their Lloyd Wright house slip quietly into the river. Somehow, I suspect not. For Monocle in Canada, I'm Hugo MacDonald.
I love Hugo's monologues. Another winner there. That's all we have time for today. Thank you to our producer, Case Bilboa, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly, our studio manager, Ben Jay. The menu is next. In 3 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. I'm Steve Bloomfield. That was Midori House. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.